name is Dan Olsen-Bang. You're listening to Syracuse University GradCast. Today, we're joined by Vinny Ustak. He is a senior machine learning engineer at GeneDx in the DC area. He is going to be speaking soon, and so I thought that in advance of his Zoom virtual session with us, his workshop, we would just have a conversation and get to know him, and you know, maybe it's a little bit of a preview of what's to come. So welcome, Vinny.
Hi, Dan. Good to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah. So this is your second time coming to Syracuse. Only, I guess, the first time was in the pre-pandemic days when more workshops were held in person than not. You'll be on Zoom this time, but I think it's still going to be a really wonderful experience for everybody. And so in the interest of just, you know, learning a little bit about you, why don't we start there? So tell us about what you do now.
Yeah, so GeneDx is a medical diagnostic laboratory. We diagnose rare inherited diseases, rare genetic diseases. So, you know, we're really pushing on exome testing and genome testing. Exome is like the coding part of the genome. And so we're looking through, you know, the genetic needle in a haystack for the one variant. It could be like one nucleotide that's off, that's causing, you know, pretty severe disease in, for example, a young child. So as a machine learning engineer, I'm working on various ML-based projects in order, you know, using our retrospective data, which is a huge data set, in order to improve our clinical operations workflow. So really, like, you know, you have a genetic sample that arrives in the lab, and in the end, when we finally send out a report, like, that's kind of all the steps in between is the clinical operations workflow. And so I'm working to improve processes in there.
That's really interesting. Can you talk about some of the diseases that you work on? I know that there are some extremely rare diseases. I think it's sort of interesting to, you know, just to name some of the things that might be addressed through the research that you do.
Yeah, so I don't focus on individual diseases, but in general, you know, there are, for example, if you have an issue with a sodium pump that would be in one of your, you know, nerve cells, then you could have potentially 40 seizures a day. And that same genetic variant could also cause pretty serious like developmental delays. So, you know, you could have a situation where a patient is maybe 4 years old and is totally nonverbal, needs 24-hour care because they have, you know, 40 seizures a day, for example. And of course, they're, you know, really every organ system can be affected by genetic disease, and sometimes multiple organ systems are affected. Wow. I mean, if you know anyone, you know, let's say one that maybe people know a lot about, but it's not as rare as a lot of what we deal with is, you know, if anyone in your family had, for example, Down syndrome, then it's not just the like developmental delays, but also a lot of times people will have eye surgeries, heart surgeries, ear surgeries, you know, just like surgery after surgery just to, you know, keep things stable, more or less.
Yeah. Okay. So the ability to diagnose these diseases is obviously very critical.
Yeah. It's the first step on the path to treatment. I mean, we don't, you know, offer treatment at GeneDx, but we can at least say that this is the molecular cause of you or your family members' issues. And for example, one step that a family could take is to go meet other families who have this issue, who have like either the same genetic variant or a genetic variant on the same gene. And then, I mean, these are we call them like orphan diseases sometimes, ultra rare diseases. So the drugs, the treatments are like orphan drugs. You know, you're not getting like seven-figure, eight-figure budgets, for example, like to fight cancer, you know, for example. But a family can get together with other families and they can raise money and they can support research laboratories to focus on treatment for a disease, characterize the disease, and then, you know, kind of push the FDA to fast track a drug.
So maybe we should then rewind a little bit. So how did you get here? How did, what kind of path did you take to this type of work?
Yeah, so I do not have a long history in the field of genetics or clinical genomics. I started my scientific career probably at the age of one, I guess, but, you know, got a BS in chemical engineering at Syracuse, class of 2008. And then I did a little bit of polymer science research at University of Connecticut. That was originally a PhD, but I mastered out. If you want to talk about that later, I'm happy to discuss that in terms of grad school experience.
Yeah.
And then had a couple of business, like purchasing jobs in New York City, where they wanted somebody with a lot of, you know, kind of technical know-how and could talk about chemicals and materials interactions and things. But it, they were purchasing roles. And then I got my PhD at UC Davis. That was a chemical engineering degree. I did computational physics simulations on models for proteins and polymers. Then I did a little bit of computational drug design. You know, I was coming out of the PhD with this computational physics. I thought, well, if I don't want to go, say, into defense, I don't want to work in a national laboratory, I don't want to work at a university, computational drug design at like a pharmaceutical company is a really obvious answer in terms of where people could go. So I did a postdoc studying computational drug design at University of Maryland, Baltimore. We had moved across the country from California to Maryland for my wife's PhD that she was just starting as I was finishing mine.
Gluttons for punishment.
Yeah, we actually, so we've been together, it'll be 11 years dating, and she just graduated in April. And since April, this is the first time that one of us has not been at least in a PhD program. So don't recommend that, but here we are with, you know, two overeducated individuals. It's great. So, so the postdoc kind of taught me like, okay, you know, this is still a lot of the same that I had been looking at, and it just wasn't where I wanted to continue. I don't really know how to describe it. Just like, I didn't feel totally settled and I wanted to be a data scientist. It was a really hot, you know, title and sounded great. The ability to look at huge amounts of data and do machine learning. And a lot of those jobs were, of course, at like insurance companies and finance companies. And I was applying to those jobs, but then I saw GeneDx and I thought this would allow me to get the title that I want and stay in molecular medicine. So it's really like a twofer. And I got the job. They really wanted somebody who had like a kind of a mathematical background and not necessarily a huge genetics background. And so that was 4 years ago where I've been, you know, since then. And so it was data scientist, senior data scientist. And then I led a team for about 6 months during a transitional period at GeneDx. And now I'm kind of rotated back to individual contributor and I'm a machine learning engineer.
That's a fascinating path. And it has some interesting threads to it that are worth sort of teasing out. One of them that I think I'm hearing a lot from you is about the kind of the search that you did for work that was compatible with your values. Seems like maybe you didn't want to do the defense route, and you know, maybe there are pros and cons to the pharmaceuticals and the finance, but it sounds like you kind of prioritize those to some degree in your search. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely called it. I have always had a really strong desire to use
this like science acumen that I've honed to do good things. You know, the field of chemical engineering was sort of invented to, you know, help pull petroleum out of the ground and then crack it into all its various, you know, constituent components. And a lot of people, you know, that's the, if as a chemical engineer, that's like the top paying job you can get. And then obviously all these other places, you know, pay very well, of course. And I don't judge people for going in those directions. Just for me, I feel best when I come home from work and I thought like I really had the ability to make an impact in people's lives. And GeneDx really gives me that. I mean, you know, I talked about those, you know, those terrible situations that families can find themselves in. And it really feels like I'm doing something special to help these families that are affected by rare and ultra rare diseases. Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting. I think that a lot of people who get PhDs feel or are maybe made to feel that getting a job is something worth thanking your lucky stars for, and thinking about how your values, and even you talked about being in a particular place and getting a job in a place where you are rather than moving across the country for something. You know, these are sometimes, I think, in two foreign concepts for people getting PhDs, but I think it's worth highlighting the ways that your values should and do play into the kind of work that you do and how you move forward from your, you know, from the program onward from there.
Yeah. I mean, my location was kind of non-negotiable. I, you know, wanted to live where my then fiance lived, and she was a PhD student at University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland. And, you know, I did apply to lots of jobs, and that had to be geographically focused. And I sort of, you know, just waited until something that was workable came along for me. I think when, I mean, you have to appreciate that the percentage of people who earn PhDs is quite low, and there are certain jobs that would only consider a PhD, or in, you know, certain circumstances, somebody who was really talented but didn't happen to have those three letters after their name. All that to say is I do find PhDs to be valuable, and I learned a lot, and we can talk about that. But yeah, I think, I mean, to me, it seemed like if you're willing to not take the very first thing, and you have some patience and maybe, you know, a little bit saved up from your PhD, which is hard to do, but you know, you don't have to just jump on that first thing and pack up and move you or your family all the way across the country. I mean, you can find a workable situation. And of course, now with we're in the not post pandemic world, but
the mid post pandemic world.
Post COVID happening. All this remote work allows us to, you know, really be anywhere. So if location is important to you, you know, you don't want to leave where you're, you know, a lot of things to consider, where your aging parents are or where your spouse lives and has a permanent job that can't leave and can't be remote. I mean, now remote jobs are a real option, I think, for workers who are in high demand. And I think PhD workers are in pretty high demand. That's my experience anyways. I mean, I can't speak for every field and every individual, but that's what I've seen myself.
You've also hinted at or alluded to some mess along the way. Do you want to talk about that, about the mastering out and about, you know, seemingly multiple postdocs in different areas? I'd be curious to know how you kind of map that or how you see that even in hindsight.
It was just one postdoc. I only did one postdoc, but mastering out was a real challenge for me. I think, I mean, emotionally it was hard because I had spent 2 years and thought, okay, probably have another three, let's say. But just at the time, it really wasn't right for me. And I felt really bad about it. And then a few years later, as I was hearing from my cohort at UConn that they had graduated, and I said, if I had just, you know, by now I could have a PhD. But at that point, I was still in the first year of the second go at it. But it's not the end of the world. You know, I still got a master's, which was great. And not, by the way, not all programs will let you master out these days. Some people, maybe in certain departments, too many people have mastered out and they don't want to support a master's student in the same way that they would want to support a PhD student. So they don't give you the option to do that. But in the end, it all worked out for me, right? I mean, I went and had, you know, a lot of fun in New York and had some interesting jobs. And then, you know, just eventually did get the PhD. And I'm proud of the path that I took, even if I wasn't so much at the time. And so anybody out there who's considering, you know, mastering out or going back to school, you know, all paths are available to you if you're, you know, willing to make it work for yourself.
That's I think those are valuable thoughts. And there is so much baggage around these things and the difficulties people have, and also just the difficulty of not being sure exactly what you want to do. And, you know, you alluded to this feeling like this is fine, but it's not exactly what I'm going for. It doesn't quite fit. And I think those are all kind of important things to highlight and to recognize are very common experiences. You don't always get it right on the first try. And that doesn't necessarily mean that something terrible is happening. It just means that you might want to think about how you can adapt.
Yeah, I mean, you could even, beyond dropping out, mastering out of graduate school, I mean, from what I told you about what I've actually focused on in my work, I've kind of changed fields many times. And so that right there is, you know, giving up. You know, by the end of my PhD, you're considered like an expert in some field. And I gave up that like biophysics and computational physics expertise to go into, you know, genetics. And so I had to start over and being a novice again. And so in that regard as well, like like I said, it wasn't quite working for me, and it's taken me a while to like get that, you know, confidence again at work, and to be an authority on certain subjects, but here I am. And I do really, you know, and I was, what am I now? I'm 37, and I guess I was 33 when I hopefully found my final field, which would be genetics, you know, God willing, if I stick around and everything works out. So, you know, it's like, what do I want to be when I grow up? Like, I'll figure it out tomorrow. But just, you know, I love working in genetics, and it is really working for me. And so, you know, when I say like all paths are available, it's, you know, you have to figure out how to make that work and if it can work for you. But getting like a degree like chemical engineering really sets you up for kind of making what you want out of your path. Learning a lot of math, learning a lot of problem solving, you know, the ability to teach yourself new things. I think it opened a lot of doors rather than like pigeonholing me into just like the field of chemical engineering.
That's really excellent. So I'm wondering, based on your experience, and you've had a variety of them, what kind of advice would you have for a current PhD student or even a postdoc?
So I would say that if you're finishing your PhD or you're finishing your postdoc, you're obviously looking towards like, what's the next thing? What is going to like really be this great crescendo where I've worked so hard to earn this terminal degree? You know, you may not get the most amazing job right away. You may just need to take a job, but then getting the second job will be that much easier when you're actually in industry. say, and I can only really speak to like going from a postdoc to industry at, you know, academia is a whole other can of worms, but I think you have to, if you're going to stay in the same field, then that's probably easier. What I did is I kind of transitioned. So I thought about what have I learned in my PhD and in my postdoc that is going to translate to like a data scientist job. And, you know, that was how to work with huge sets of data, how to program, how to do data visualization, how to, you know, present data, how to write scientifically. You'd be surprised actually at what's considered machine learning. Like technically linear regression is machine learning. And so you've probably learned a lot of things that are going to be really translatable to like a data scientist job or a machine learning job, for example. And so I think coming up with a plan for yourself, if you know you're going to transition and switch, maybe, and then maybe in the last year of your PhD, you get a little opportunity to focus on something that you'd like to do. And you think about how can I, you know, while staying in your field of expertise, how can I kind of leverage this time in graduate school to help me transition into something where I know I'm going to switch fields, for example.
That's good. And there can be more modularity to this than people often think, and less of a linearity. Once you get out into the world and you're trying to make things happen for yourself, all of the our linear fantasies go out the window, and you might as well just know it and anticipate it. And it's an okay thing to do.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. I mean, you never know where tomorrow is going to lead you. I mean, that's really trite and overused, but if you're brave and can go with the flow and hopefully have a little bit of an optimistic attitude, which I think I do, that things will work out for you, and that you've done a lot of work to distinguish yourself and to learn a lot, and develop skills that are in demand. Yeah, things will work out for you.
I like your optimism. But I also think that there is a lot of practicality built into that, which is really important. I mean, you have to recognize the ways that you're responsible to create opportunities, while also, you know, kind of accepting things as they come. Because both of those factors are there, and they're both important.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Rolling with the punches and
expecting that there will be punches.
Yeah, right. And moving forward. I mean, yeah, life, you know, that's life, of course. Things always come along.
Yeah. Well, Vinny, thank you so much for taking the time. I think that you're sort of, I guess, online visit coming up on September 14th it's coming up, and it's going to be a really great opportunity for people to hear more about you, to ask questions and to learn from you. And so I think we look forward to it. And I think this has been a great conversation.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I do want to say one more thing. Shout out to Dan, because in early 2019, I called Syracuse or emailed and was looking for career advice, even though it had been a long time since I had been there. But Dan gave me hours of his time and looked at my resume and said, oh yeah, you can have a 2-page resume if you're graduating with a PhD. And you know, he gave me advice that rang really true, which is you should expect to be mid-level if you graduate with a PhD but have no industry experience. And then you can get to senior level within, you know, a year or 2 years. And that totally happened. And it let me, you know, gave me confidence that like, it was just going to take a little while to like, have my real experience be reflected in my like industry experience. So thanks a lot to, you know, to Dan and what he did for me in the really early stages of my late stage academia, early stage industry experience. And it's been great.
Vinny. Yeah. And that's a great plug. I'll take it. And thank you, everybody, for listening. This is Syracuse University GradCast.